Hey, what's up, everybody? My name's MJ, and you're listening to the MTG in Quarantine podcast. As usual, I'd like to give a quick shout-out to my local game store, Guardian Games. You can find Guardian Games on the web at ggportland.com. Today's episode is another in the Control Room series, where I bring my friend Ryan, aka Sodium Chloride, in the MTG in Quarantine Discord server, on as guest host to talk about all sorts of different and amazing magic topics. So without further ado, I'd like to reintroduce my friend Ryan back to the show. Hey Ryan, how's it going here today?
Oh, things are doing pretty well.
Yeah,
glad
definitely.
Glad to be back on the old podcast-a-rooney.
Yep, it's good to have you here. So the topic of today's episode is definitely something that I feel tails really well with the budget deck episode I released yesterday when I had Titanic Ultimatum, aka MTG Naya Guy, on the podcast yesterday talking about building budgets. So again, we are doing specifically $50 budget EDH decks. And it got me thinking about some of the advice or some of the things that I learned when I first got started playing Magic. And I wanted to bring that into a discussion here. And that is the difference or the lack thereof of budget, or more specifically, card availability between ultra budget brew. So again, let's say like the $25 to $50 EDH decks versus something that if you put all the cards in there together and you check the prices on any sort of website where obviously you have some price guide, pricing information, you would potentially have over $1,000, maybe $2,000 invested in that deck if you looked at all 100 cards. And I wanted to really just get the discussion started here today with you, Ryan. And I wanted to start just asking you, how do you think there is a difference between budget builds and the most expensive builds? Obviously, I like building budget decks. I specifically try to build decks within a reasonable dollar amount. I try not to spend too much on different cards, and I was just curious to know what you thought there might be a difference in between budget decks and between extremely expensive decks, typically looking at format staples, something like a Demonic Tutor, Rhystic Study, Cyclonic Rift, Smothering Tithe, the cards that effectively are just generically good but are extremely expensive, versus trying to find some higher mana cost, cheaper alternatives.
Yeah, I think out of the ones that you just mentioned, I think Demonic Tutor has always been somewhat expensive and has always been really good. And I think that's been the case before Commander even existed. And I also think that, unlike the other ones you mentioned, I think Demonic Tutor, there's an argument that could be made that that might actually be worth it if you really need to have a very powerful tutor for whatever reason. Whereas mm-hmm. I do think that cards like Cyclonic Rift or Smothering Tithe, I think that those ones are like the quote-unquote format staples that I think have really been in danger, especially in the last year or so, of phasing out of being staples because they have approached a ludicrous prices along with the Rhystic Study. I mean, it's very difficult for a person to argue that a card is going to be a staple in the future if acquiring a copy of that card costs, you know, between $30 and $40. You know, that's a lot of money to spend on a single card in this particular format. Now, I mean, you know, in Legacy or Vintage, that's not a whole lot of money at all, but
or Modern, for Commander, for instance, I mean, you know, with like Jund, for instance, in Modern, you're going to be needing to drop hundreds of dollars just on the three fetch lands necessary to make a three color deck run too. So
I think $600 when it comes to fetch lands, though, they've been kind of expensive for a long time. Same Shocklands have always hovered around the $10 range, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you kind of know what you're going to get into with those. Whereas I think that, like, the prices on some things have crept up, like, really suddenly in the last couple of years on a lot of cards that were formerly considered, you know, moderately priced cards with that had really good, powerful effects. I think one of the problems is that there's been a lot of interest in Magic the Gathering, record interest in starting to play the game, particularly Commander. You know, you combine that with the fact that there's a limited availability of cards because there's only so much they can reprint, and suddenly you have situations where you have, you know, Creator Hoof Behemoth is like a $60 card or whatever. And, you know, I think that at that point, when you're looking at spending that much on a card, it had better be on the reserve list, and it better be like a really good card. Like I'm talking like Academy Rector, or maybe like Opalescence, or you know, one of the really good classic cards from the Urza days. Like I would not roll that much money into a card that's not even on the reserve list. For one, because it could get reprinted, but also because that's kind of ludicrous. I don't think the power level of some of the cards right now where they're at, I don't think it justifies paying that much when you could say, instead of spending all of that money on a Creator Hoof, you could spend it on just, you know, playing one of the many different overrun type of cards, you know, creatures with overrun effects stapled onto them, planeswalkers, instant sorceries. You know, there is probably 30 cards that do similar kinds of effects, and a lot of them are only very, very marginally worse than Creator Hoof.
Sure.
And I think that's the big thing is like, is it really worth it to spend that much money to see marginal improvement on something? I mean, you can run a Time Twister. Time Twister is the best maybe wheel effect that you can get in its color, and probably the best wheel effect in the game. It's a power 9 card. It is great. Is it really worth it, given that it's only maybe very, very, very marginally better than some of the other blue alternative cards that can also act as draw spells?
Windfall, for instance.
Yeah, Windfall, for instance. And, you know, given that a copy of Time Twister could probably, like, bare minimum, thousands, you know?
Yeah.
And you could just get a Windfall for, like...
$3, $4.
$3? I mean, I'm talking, that's 1,000% increase right there. I don't know. I mean, I think that there's a pretty strong argument to be made that there, you have to make a cost benefit analysis here and really ask whether that much extra money is really going to buy you what you need.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to preface this discussion. I should have done this before, but I wanted to preface the discussion with something that a conversation I had when I was first learning how to play Magic. So I obviously had a really garbage commander deck when I was first learning how to play. It was 360 card constructed decks smashed together into what kind of masqueraded as a 100 card commander deck. And I was playing at my local game store's Sunday afternoon commander games. And I was playing against an opponent who boasted that he had about $1,500 worth of cards in his deck. I don't even know if I had $25 worth of cards in my deck. My deck was absolute trash. But again, that's beside the point. And I commented after the game, obviously I was still extremely green to all this, I didn't really understand. I asked him how his deck never, ever lost. I mean, because he didn't win that game. Obviously, we're in a four-player format. You know, the other two players do have a lot of pull on how the games turn out. Anyway, but I figured that since he had spent so much money on his deck, he would be absolutely unbeatable. And he made a comment to me that's actually really stuck with me and has really been an emphasis for a lot of my budget deck building. And that's the fact that he had made a comment that his deck, which, again, I don't remember if it was a combo deck or exactly what it was, had lost to plenty of pre-con level decks in its time. Obviously, it won a lot, but also lost to decks that were, in theory, far inferior to it in terms of, if we want to use the debatable quote-unquote power level conversation here, but that he had lost a lot of games to decks that really had, in terms of cardboard monetary value or potentially even overall gameplay value, had no business playing at the same table and winning. So that was really my first introduction to the concept of Magic, where you don't have to have the most powerful, the most expensive cards in order to be able to play Commander. And that's really what I wanted to get into here today, is because, again, I really enjoy building budget decks. Part of that is the fact that I don't want to spend $1,000 on a deck, especially if, you know, it requires me to buy a lot of cards I can't use for other decks. What if I lose interest in that deck? What happens if I lose the deck? Well, all of a sudden, you're out a whole bunch of money if you've put all this cash and capital into extremely expensive pieces of cardboard. Whereas if you put a, let's say, a $50 deck together, if you decide tomorrow that, hey, this deck really isn't working out, you can just tear it apart. You can take the pieces of value out of there, throw everything else back in the long box, and you really don't care. You don't think about it again. And a lot of those cards, hopefully, you took out will have some utility in other pieces, in other decks, other places, et cetera, et cetera. And so I wanted to really start there with that. Obviously, since I build a lot of budget decks, I have a lot of experience with this. But Ryan, I was just curious about you. Is what do you think about when you're trying to build a new deck as far as like the budget? So again, I will preface this question first by mentioning that we are not the first ones to be talking about marginal improvement regarding extremely expensive quote-unquote format staples. Obviously, if you're going to throw something like Rhystic Study into your deck will probably be better in, if we again want to use the power level conversation here. Again, I'm not going to go down that road, but if we talk about the power level conversation, throwing a Rhystic Study into your deck is probably going to help you win more games just because it's an objectively powerful card. However, the fact that there are so many cards in Magic's history demonstrates that there is always room for a budget alternative. It may not be as good as Rhystic Study, but if you even throw something that's, again, better than a Divination, but let's say a Thirst for Knowledge or something, or any of the instant speed draw spells in blue, let's say, well, all of a sudden, you're not quite getting the same incremental amount of value out of those, out of that one card in your deck, but you might still be able to draw four or five cards. Again, Rhystic Study is not foolproof. People can try to work around that versus where a singular instant draw spell, for instance, if it's not countered, you're guaranteed, let's say, four to five cards. So I guess my question for you, Ryan, is this. Do you try to build decks with a certain budget in mind? So when you're buying your cards, let's say for this Volrath deck you've been working on the last few weeks, did you go into that thinking, I need to put extremely expensive or, you know, solid format staples that are like $10 to $15 in the deck, which, again, since you're playing in Sultai colors, are going to be some of the most powerful cards in the game, potentially. Did you feel that you needed to include some of those cards, the Demonic Tutors, the Rhystic Studies, things like that, into your deck? Or did you feel like you could find budget alternatives elsewhere that would still give you some value, but may not be quite as powerful, but still give you a functional effect?
Paying attention to the budget of anything, really. The way I've been acquiring things to construct these decks recently is just to order a crap ton of cards on the TCG player and just like one of each a la carte and just be like, ooh, this card looks interesting, buy. This card looks interesting, buy. And then like order 500 cards on there.
Sure, but, sure.
Like, I mean, it's easier to, the thing is, it's always been easy for me to justify it, to be like, oh, this card's 50 cents. Oh, this card's $1. You know, and just do that over and over and over again. And eventually you're like, oh, wait, I have $70, $80 in my cart. And then they're all those. It's just like you realize you have like 70, like 50 cent or $1 cards in there. I mean, that's not saying I wouldn't if there was it's all about the cost benefit. Right. Mm-hmm. I'd say that it's easier for me to justify spending money on cards that are of a moderate to low price. So cards that are within the dollar range. You know, rather than buying a load of cards that are between like $4 and $15 each. And then when it comes to cards more expensive than that, like, I mean, I didn't buy any for the Volrath deck. The only card recently I bought that's above $15 would be the Umezawa's Jitte that I purchased for my Wireless Voltron deck. And, you know, I'd always wanted to own that card for the longest time, but I never had any money. And now I have some money, so I bought that card. That's kind of the reason why I bought that. It wasn't because I was like, oh,
sure, sure.
I'm gonna assemble, like for example, that Wyleth deck. The most expensive permutations of a Voltron Boros deck could include. I could run every single copy of the swords, so that would set me back like what,
you know, the most expensive
ones are $40 each. So
$60 for the most expensive ones, and then down to like
$10
for the cheapest.
Or so, for the ones. So you know, like $100 or $150 for a collection, you know. The GTA is $18, so I mean that's kind of expensive, but I'm not running any of the swords in the deck. I'm not running a Hammer of Nazan right now, at least in that deck. I'm not running any of the most expensive auras or other kinds of things you can run in it. almost everything in that deck is sub $5. You know, and for the Volrath deck, I'm trying to remember here if I even have anything very expensive. The most expensive cards I think I have in that are the new lands they printed in Commander Legends, which I'm just buying up as many of those as I as I feel I'm comfortable buying, because I feel like those are just going to go up in price like crazy.
They're Commander good cards.
It's out. Oh, because I looked at the prices for those Battle Bond Commander lands, and I was like, oh crap, I'm not buying that. Like $20 or $30 for a Simic colored Battle Bond land? Hell no. I'm not paying that. So I'm just buying like two copies of each of these lands. You know, those are like between $5 and $8 or $7 each, right? Mm-hmm. Those are probably the most expensive cards. I only have one of them, I think, in the Volrath deck, and that's like $7, right? Maybe I have another colored one in there. I can't remember, but that's just my land, you know, like, yeah, that's, I don't have any big ticket items. I don't have a crater hoof behemoth hiding in that deck, you know? That could also be, though, is like the type archetype I'm pursuing with Volrath, that deck is like a +1/+1 counters, infect, card draw, sneaky creatures deck, right?
Okay.
And none of, I'm the way it turns out that infect isn't as expensive as you'd actually think. It turns out that a lot of the cards that they printed with infect are actually like 50 cents to $2 each. And they're like sneaky little cards. So that's not proven to be an expensive strategy.
Okay, so Ryan, I wanted to cut in here and just ask. So you did mention +1/+1 counters. And obviously, green has things like Doubling Season, which doubles the number of counters there.
I'm not playing that.
But
that's like a $40 card.
I know. But I guess the point of the episode here is to ask the question, yes, Doubling Season would make your deck quote-unquote more powerful because it's just an objectively good card. However, in your estimation, do you need that kind of card in your deck? Need to be able to play at casual tables?
I wouldn't put a Doubling Season in the deck. I mean, first of all, I think I'm running lots of proliferate effects in that because the proliferate both works with the +1/+1 counters, which synergizes with Volrath, and it also synergizes with the infect. So I have multiple themes that have cross synergies. I would much rather run cards like Contagion Clasp or Contagion Engine. Maybe like Contagion Engine's a little pricey. Then I would run Doubling Season. I don't have a copy of Doubling Season, and I think that I think it's good. But then at the same time, I could also be like, well, why don't I just run one of the Vorinclexes? Those are also like $30 cards, you know. Like, why don't I run, like, you don't really need that. I think proliferate is fine on its own without the doubling effects. I feel like the doubling effects are almost more like if you're not going for a proliferate strategy, like, or a Simic strategy. It almost feels more like that would be for if you were playing a Selesnya, like, go wide, whatever deck, as opposed to, like, the deck I'm playing, which is not go wide. It's go tall and also stealing people's creatures kind of deck. You know, okay. I don't think Doubling Season would be necessary, and I also don't think Doubling Season would be better than the proliferate cards I'm talking about, outside of a few different scenarios. Because I think that that including just one card in your deck that's like $40, I don't think it's going to be that much better than putting in a bunch of $5 or $10 cards that could in your deck. You're going to draw those cards more often because there are more of them, and you know it's also going to be that they're going to have more of an effect on your deck. I mean, there's better ways to use that money, in my opinion.
But you still, if you really wanted to and money was no object, would you still run Doubling Season in a deck where you felt like it would actually have a good effect?
I mean, if I was running a deck that specifically was counter-themed and I didn't wasn't helming it with Volrath and the counters themselves were the win condition, like if I was, Simic Ascendancy or... a couple other cards like that, you know, and I was just trying to build counters just exclusively, then yeah, I would, if it was exclusively a counter race. But, you know, I don't think that Doubling Season, and I wouldn't, unless I had it around, I wouldn't put it in a deck. It's the same thing I feel about Anointed Procession. That's like $30. Mm-hmm. I got my copy for free. I think my brother gave it to me when I played in a draft and during the Amonkhet block. And that card was not nearly as expensive then as it is now. It's actually like one of the most expensive enchantments out there that wasn't, you know, that isn't on the reserved list. You know, along with Doubling Season and a couple of those big, big enchantment spells. I wouldn't buy Anointed Procession, even if I was really running a token deck and really leaning hard into token generation, maybe, but it would be very difficult to get me to spend $30 on or whatever on that kind of card.
Even if price was no object.
Well, you know, I don't know. If price was no object, then yeah, but then I'd have to worry. If price was no object, then I'd really worried about runaway power level in terms of my decks, because I don't want to fill all my decks with every kind of tutor, with every kind of expensive creature, and also with Chrome Mox with every single deck, and like every other expensive card. I can maybe throw a Time Twister in every deck, you know? I think that... Whether that would really get me that much of a benefit it remains to be seen, though. Like, I don't think it would be that beneficial. I mean, maybe, but I can think of a billion better ways to spend your money.
Sure. So that's really what I wanted to get to in this episode, is the fact that neither of us really feel like you absolutely have to play the most powerful cards in the game to be able to have a very functioning deck that does things. For instance, I do have a copy of both Demonic Tutor and Rhystic Study. They are objectively powerful cards. And you know what? I play both of them in exactly one deck each. And part of that is because, obviously, I don't want to be trying to swap my Rhystic Study between every single deck that I have that runs blue in it. But also just the fact that it doesn't always fit in every deck. And there's a reason for that, because... Well, Rhystic Study is overly powerful. One, it's also a magnet for other people's ire, so if you play Rhystic Study in any deck, really any situation, especially if you can get that out early, all of a sudden everyone's going to get really annoyed at you. It's like turn one Sol Ring, honestly. And that's not necessarily the place you want to be in when you're playing a four-player game of EDH. But I also don't run it in other decks where it just doesn't synergize. What I'm trying to get at here is the fact that I definitely am in the camp that you don't just jam as many expensive staples into every deck as possible, because not every staple, like you said with Annoying Procession or Doubling Season, is going to work in every application. For instance, if you're running a Spellslinger deck, well, you're probably not going to need an enchantment that is going to sit there and not provide you any value unless your opponents are actively doing something. It's not going to help you on your turn or anything you're trying to do. Versus even Divination in that case. 3 mana for 2 cards. All of a sudden in a Spellslinger deck, you're off to the races at that point. You're doing something with your mana that's not just sitting there. And I really just wanted to challenge the concepts of staples here. Is, well, it's nice to have them. You can obviously create very powerful decks using the most expensive cards. That's the whole reason why CEDH exists. And why all of those format staples are extremely expensive. It's why a lot of people proxy cards because obviously we can't all afford $1,500 to $2,000 decks that we may not play all that often. And even if we do, that's a lot of money to be putting into cardboard. But I think we also have to consider the fact that budget just kind of ends up being the default in a lot of cases, either because you have a monetary restriction where you either don't have the cash to be able to drop on an extremely expensive card or don't want to, and that really does tend to push you towards budget building. And again, since I build a lot of budget decks, I have really found a lot of value in trying to find overly powerful cards and then seeing how I can downgrade the actual financial cost of those cards by finding functional alternatives. Again, if you wanted a Demonic Tutor in your deck, but you don't have a Demonic Tutor, Diabolic Tutor is just 2 mana more, 1 generic, 1 black more, and it does the exact same thing. So things like that can be done to create a budget deck that still functions fairly similarly to the quote-unquote more powerful, more expensive decks. And I guess the next question here, the next piece of discussion I wanted to bring up, is just the fact that we're looking at all these ridiculous reserved list card buyouts. Obviously, the secret's out of the bag on that one. It's been out of the bag for months. And we've seen a lot of cards, both good and absolutely terrible, go up in price. And so for every card that has a lot of value that's on the reserved list, there's just a lot of really crappy cards that are also expensive just because they have that reserved list status. And I was just curious to get what your thoughts were on some of this. Would you purchase a reserved list card knowing that it's objectively powerful but being dropping who knows how much on it versus potentially just letting those cards go, especially as they get more expensive?
I mean, if I can go on mtgstocks.com and look at a particular reserved list card and see that it is spiking, I am not going anywhere near that card, because that is an objectively bad idea to spend like $30 on a reserved list card that was only $5 like a year ago, because the value of that card is going to rapidly decline, and then you're going to get left with the reality that you spent like $25 on a card which is now worth $5. And I'm not going to pay that much for a card that isn't even worth that much money. It's even one thing to pay that much for a Rhystic Study. It's a whole nother to pay that much money for some of the garbage rares that have spiked during these buyouts recently. Like some cards that are really not worth like $10 and that were 50 cents a couple years ago, you know, it's just not worth it. Some of these other cards, like you could justify if the prices were lower buying some of these cards. For example, I have a practical example here in the card, Retribution of the Meek. Mm-hmm. It's a 3-drop white sorcery that says destroy all creatures with power 4 or greater. That back in 2016, that was a $2.80 card. Now that's a $21 card. Is it worth buying for $21? No, it's not. I have another card here that's basically, effectively strictly better than that, called Slaughter the Strong, which costs 1 generic and 2 white. It was first printed in Rivals of Ixalan and then reprinted in Commander Legends at an uncommon, rarity. It's also a sorcery, and it states each player chooses any number of creatures they control with total power 4 or less, then sacrifices all other creatures they control. So, nearly identical in terms of its actual effect to Retribution of the Meek, except it's slightly less splashable in terms of its color. But actually, functionally, you could almost dang near say this is very much a strictly better card, because it actually has players sacrifice creatures with power 4 or greater, rather than just destroying them. So it gets around indestructible, it gets around hexproof, it gets around 1 billion other things. You can't regenerate the creature. Unless a person decides to blink their whole army out, they're in for a bad time if they've got a bunch of big fatties down on the battlefield. Also, here's another point to point out. Slaughter the Strong right now is running for about 18 cents. It is way underplayed, in my opinion. It is a great card. It costs 18 cents, and Retribution of the Meek costs $21. And for all intents and purposes, is a worse card.
Not in all situations. Obviously, Retribution of the Meek can provide you protection if you have a whole bunch of small creatures. Versus Slaughter the Strong, if you it still affects you. It is a symmetrical effect, so you still have to work around it. So I would consider it not as good if we wanted to look at it on a level playing field, but if you play in something like Arcades, the Strategist, for instance, and you have a whole bunch of walls with zero power, all of a sudden that is basically a one-sided board wipe. So
Well, all both of them are actually symmetrical they're not one-sided. Both of them are basically destroy all creatures with power 4 or greater, including your own, if you have them.
Slaughter the Strong actually requires you to count up to 4 total power, so you actually end up having to sacrifice creatures as well.
Ah, okay. But effectively, what it does is it's the same kind of card in terms of it rewards you for having creatures with low power level.
Sure, right? Sure.
And Retribution of the Meek, in terms of a card, in terms of a board wipe, is with the effect as printed, is not worth that much money. There are a lot of other board wipes that I would much rather run than that. I would much rather run a Black Sun Zenith and then be able to control how much damage I'm outputting than run Retribution of the Meek, especially considering Black Sun Zenith is what, probably less expensive than that?
Oh yeah, definitely.
And Black Sun Zenith is better. I mean, I can't say strictly better because they're not the same color and don't even do exactly the same thing, but I mean, this is only one example here. There's a bunch of other examples.
You could also throw a Toxic Deluge into this, even though
Hell yeah.
Yeah, that one is about $10 or so now. I mean, since it was reprinted in Double Masters, but Toxic Deluge is kind of one of those staples where I feel like, again, it doesn't go in every deck, especially if you're doing a lot of life loss. And so if you're playing Vilas, it works really well, but you just have to be careful with that one. But yeah, that's a card I feel that's kind of in this gray area for me between staple and something that is not a staple. At least the community does not recognize as a staple. His Toxic Deluge just has so many applications to it. Is that it feels like a staple, but in the way I build my decks, I have a single copy of it, okay? And yeah. I've included in one deck specifically where I felt like it really had the ability to do what I needed it to do, because while it is generically powerful, again, it does have a major downside. You do need to pay life, and you're not always going to have that life available to you when you're activating the spell as sorcery speed. So there are limits to, again, Toxic Deluge, but if we're just talking about something comparing to Retribution in the Meek, I would consider Toxic Deluge to be leaps and bounds better, just because it costs less financially and mana cost. It's in black, but yeah. it basically does the same thing. It just does it better.
Yeah, and here's the other point to put out there, is that if you're running an Arcadius the Strategist or an Obzon Tree Dude who, you know,
Doran
Toughness Matters kind of deck, right? Either yeah. Wall Tribal, Toughness Matters, or Defender Matters, and you have creatures with 1 power or 0 power. Let's say you have a bunch of walls out and they'll have 0 power. Slaughter the Strong is effectively identical to Retribution of the Meek in that situation, except that it sacrifices creatures. But the most important thing that like people should take away from this is that one of them costs 18 cents and the other one costs $22. And I would much rather take that $22 and slap that down as like the down payment on a Damnation than I would put it on a whatever Retribution of the Meek.
Or
Damnation is an absolute powerhouse.
Or even just a Wrath of God, if you're looking for the same.
Yeah, Wrath of God.
Yeah, because that right
$2
there.
$2 now or something?
Well, Wrath of God's still like $4 to $8, depending on which version you get. Obviously more the further back you go. But Wrath of God is definitely, is good in a lot of situations. Obviously Retribution of the Meek is good in a lot of situations. But you're right, it is a situational card where you really need a lot of things to go right in order for Retribution of the Meek to work, whereas Wrath of God is just, it's unconditional. It blows everything up. So you have to work around it a little more for Wrath of God, but it really, ultimately, what we're trying to get here is that it's going to depend on the situation. Obviously, Retribution of the Meek is a good card in certain situations. Wrath of God is good in certain situations. How often are you going to need Retribution of the Meek's ability specifically, where it is strictly better in your deck in the majority of situations over Wrath of God? And that's or Slaughter the Strong. And that's really the question that we're trying to ask here, is how many times in the course of you playing your deck do you feel that extremely powerful and expensive cards are necessary in order to be able to run your deck to the best of its ability, barring, let's say, being at the highest power levels, where obviously you have to do that. But it, like the, let's say the middle casual tiers that you and I, Ryan, we play at a lot, the battle cruiser up to, let's say, like what Channel Fireball called not optimized, but the kind of formulated or just functionally decent decks, I guess, for lack of a better term. It's escaping me right now. But most of the time, I don't think you need the most powerful, the most expensive cards to be able to play at that tier. One, because, again, you're going to be a target. But also, two, because a lot of those cards may not really work in your deck the same way the functional cheap reprints or functionally cheap cards might in a lot of situations in your deck.
I mean, right now, there are tons of cards that are spiking, not even only like reserved list cards, but all kinds of other cards. If you just look at the price lists here, do you want to pay, let's see here, $6 for a copy of Camel from Arabian Nights? No, I don't want to pay $6 for a copy of Camel that can band with deserts or whatever its ability is. Like, I mean, right now, Insurrection is like, ooh, Insurrection is spiking in price. That's crazy. Well, Insurrection is actually one of those cards that I would say is actually worth it if you're paying up to $20 for it, because that card is absolutely an
absolute game ending effect, potentially.
Yeah, it pretty much is a mono red win the game button. Okay, not as much as whatever it is, the black one that just nails your Torment of Hailfire.
Torment of Hailfire,
you know,
yeah.
That one's just cheap. That's just cheap. At least, you know, with Insurrection, you're like, I'm paying 8 mana on this thing. Like, I deserve this. Like, give this one to me, you know?
How is that any different than Craterhoof Behemoth? They both basically do the same thing, and you're not always guaranteed to win with Insurrection. So,
oh, yeah.
I guess the question for you on this one and where we're going in this discussion is, what makes Insurrection effectively better, in your opinion, than Craterhoof Behemoth?
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you up front why it is, because it's all about the cost-benefit analysis. So, you know, a year ago, Insurrection was $9.30 a copy, right? You know, right now, it looks like it's hovering around market at about $11, $11 to $15. Crater of Behemoth is like, what, $60 at this point?
$60, roughly, even though it was reprinted Jumpstart, but again, there were...
It's never going to go down, it seems like, no matter how much they reprint that thing.
No, it was hardly a reprint, though.
You can buy 6 Insurrections for the price of a Crater Hoof. Both of them are win the game buttons, yes, but one of them is 6 times less expensive, even now. I'm saying that, like... what is it? Both those new Garruk cards, Return of the Wildspeaker, that one can draw you a bunch of cards, or it can give everything like +3/+3, right?
Gives you that
an overrun effect. You can, the original overrun, which is the daddy of all of those cards, costs you about 20 cents and gives everything +3/+3 and trample.
Requires
and
triple green, also, but still, it's very doable in EDH.
And then there's the other card that's like almost strictly better than Overrun. I think they printed an M19 or whatever, which is just like, it gives everything plus whatever, equivalent to the creature with the highest power or something like that you have. So like, that's similar to Craterhoof as well.
And then you also have Triumph of the Hordes, which is about $10 to $12, which is basically Craterhoof Behemoth, but almost in a way easier.
Yeah, easier to stick out. And, you know, a lot of these are not even creatures, which means that they have to be countered by your opponents. They can't, your opponent can't just, you know, if you drop a Crater Hoof, it does all those great things, but your opponent could just, you know, like, Swords to Plowshares your Crater Hoof or whatever.
Well,
and
it's an ETB ability, so they would have have to full counter it. But the fact is that you're going out on a limb more, whereas Triumph of the Hordes costs 4 or 5 mana, and all of a sudden you can give all your creatures infect. Well, if you have a board state, you can probably kill someone right then and there. And again, it may not be as good in all situations as Craterhoof Behemoth is, but if you can get it for a fifth of the price, I think it's worth still throwing in the deck there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, an Insurrection is a really good card. It also is as we refer to as a win con card or a closer, right? I don't think it's as obnoxious as a Torment of Hailfire or a Cyclonic Rift. I think those are both, in my opinion, are like, maybe that just shows my red bias here, but I think that both those are more obnoxious than Insurrection, and both of those are more expensive than Insurrection will set you back, I think. And Craterhoof is perhaps the most expensive game closer of them all, aside from some very few reserve list cards that are very expensive.
It's about the same as Blightsteel Colossus, which basically is functionally the same.
And I'd rather have a Blightsteel Colossus because that card is just a bomb.com, and that one's fun to like tinker into play. I mean, of course, Tinker is banned in EDH, so I can't tinker a Blightsteel into play, but that would be pretty funny. Whereas like Craterhoof,
sneak
like,
attack. Know,
yeah, you know, a you whip out a Blightsteel Colossus and people would be like, whoa, hey, I remember that thing from Scars of Mirrodin. Like, it's not like, oh, there comes a Craterhoof again. It's like, oh, yeah, there's that thing. And you can sneak attack it into play and kill someone with Infect. You know, what I'm saying is like, or you could just get a big beater creature and just slap down a Tainted Strike on it, like Yargle. Just play a Yargle and put Tainted Strike on it. I digress. Going back to my original point, because I'm going on a tangent here.
Sure.
There are cards, even big closers, big win con cards, cards that you want to have that are often more expensive than others. There are better options among that pool of cards. There are some cards that are closers like Storm Herd that are like, what, 30-cent cards, 40-cent cards?
Costs 9 mana, but it's extremely effective, especially if you have life gain synergies.
It's expensive, but it will basically win you the game unless a person board wipes in defense.
Which has happened in our pod before, and I've been the one wiping the board.
I've come to realize that the pod that I play in, there's a lot of manipulation of the stack and in response. Lots of things being played in response.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Particularly when I whip out the old Sunforger and I start just searching my library and Demonic Tutor. It's better than Demonic Tutor, actually, because I'm putting it into play.
Yeah, it is.
By the time I'm to that portion of the game, things get crazy. But I digress. Storm Herd, is a win con card that is very cheap because a lot of people don't think it's very good. A lot of people pull it out of the pre-con decks when they throw it in there. I think it is a card in the same genre as Insurrection. I don't think it's quite as good as Insurrection, but it is a card that if no one has responses to it when you throw it into play, you win because there's no one at the table who will be able to, unless they have a card like Ghostly Prison or Propaganda or something like that, which can just bog down your creatures, they're not going to be able to survive that because you're just going to fly over them and kill them. I think those cards, there are some very cheap cards that allow you to close out a game, even though that there are other cards that are really expensive. And the question is like, what is the dollar amount that determines whether a card is worth it or not? I think that there is certain... Unless a card is very important for your deck, I don't think that you should spend more than $30 on a card. I don't even think you should spend $25 on a card unless it is absolutely like the card that is pivotal for your deck.
Okay. Ryan, again, I'm going to jump in here. So I have a question for you based on the title of this podcast episode. If I was to give you a vacuum, you know, where I'm going to give you two random decks and you don't know anything about the deck aside from the one card that I'm going to include. I am going to ask you this question. Would you believe that the deck that is more powerful is the one that runs a zero cost artifact called Mana Crypt, which gives you three colorless mana, but also can potentially ping you for three in the face every turn if you lose the flip, or if I give you another zero-cost artifact called Tormod's Crypt, which hoses someone's graveyard by exiling it. If in a vacuum, which deck would you think would be better and why?
So what was the first one again?
Deck number one has Mana Crypt in it. That's all you know about the deck. You have no idea
the same one has Tormod's Crypt in it.
And deck two has Tormod's Crypt in it. Again, you don't know the commanders. Mm-hmm. You don't know the colors. You just know that there's a zero drop artifact with Crypt in the name. Which deck do you think would be better and why?
Well, given that I know both cards intimately and familiarly, and given that both cards are kind of from the same era in Magic's history, I'd say that both people playing both those cards probably are digging deeper into Magic's card pool. I know that Tormod's Crypt is not an expensive card because it's been reprinted a gajillion times, but it is still the earliest form of graveyard hate that, or one of the earliest forms of graveyard hate that is, that was ever printed in Magic. And Mana Crypt is a very, very good, if not probably the best,
mana rock outside from Sol Ring.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple Grim Monoliths here that
Mana Crypt does not have an untap cost. You are guaranteed that 3 mana every turn, mm-hmm. whereas with the Monolith, have to untap.
The Monolith does well with certain deck types and certain combos. There's a couple of expensive combos with that. And Cleft is on the reserve list. So,
but back to the question, if in a vacuum, which deck do you think would be more powerful? Either deck number 1 with Mana Crypt in it or deck number 2 with Tormod's Crypt in it, and why?
Well, I mean, going by the dollar amount alone, Mana Crypt is going to set you back like $70. Or is it even higher
It's over 100.
Okay.
Well, it's about 130 currently.
I'm just totally out of date, I guess, on what I think certain things are in terms of price. Okay. So there is a small chance that this is a person who's running like a dirtly, like low power deck, and they just happen to have a Mana Crypt lying around, and they're like, and they throw it in their deck, and they're the kind of person who are like, oh, well, you know, I just have my Underground Sea in this deck. Don't worry, guys. I know that's like a $500 card or $800 card or whatever. That doesn't mean my whole deck is, all the other cards in the deck are like $2. Like, I'm just planning to dirtle around just because I'm dropping this. I'm not going to kill you all on turn one, I promise. There's a small possibility it's like that. But there's a greater possibility that a person is dropping a Mana Crypt down on the table, and they have a lot of other cards like Mana Crypt. So that would include the other cards that are the best in their class over the entire history of Magic. In which case, that is a very frightening possibility.
Unless you're playing CDH, but if you had no idea exactly what was in there.
Yeah, if you had no idea what's in the deck, I would be more concerned with the person who drops a Mana Crypt than the person who drops a Tormod Crypt, unless the person who's dropping the Tormod's Crypt says something about how they're playing Stax or Hate Bears, in which case I would be more concerned about them immediately out of the gate, or they're planning like targeted land destruction or something, you know. But I would be more concerned about the person who's willing to drop that kind of money on a card than a person who's playing budget cards, unless the person is playing a commander like Prosh, Sky Raider of Care, or Urza, or some other powerhouse commander, in which case anything they play could end up being scary in the next few moments of the game.
So what you're saying is that money, in theory, in terms of one card, if you know the one card there, is more likely to tell you that that deck is probably more expensive, and we immediately think that it's going to be a better deck, right?
Well, yeah, and it's not going to be necessarily a better deck than the CEH decks that I mentioned. Like, if someone is playing a Prosh or something like that, or they're going for one of the infinite combo strategies. But it does mean that money might not be an object to that person sitting across from you, which...
Yeah, but again, you did bring up the concept, and that's where I wanted to go with this, is that you aren't quite sure. It's very possible that the person running Mana Crypt, they're just running Mana Crypt because they have it in their collection, and it's an objectively good mana rock. Like I said, if it's actually the best mana rock in the game. And
that's the problem inherent in it, is that you're not sure 100%. But generally, like, you know, when people are willing to drop that much money, there are also people who are willing to drop money on other things.
But couldn't a deck running Tormod's Crypt also be extremely expensive? They're just running a 15-cent card?
It depends on, again, what commander they're running and what the other details are of the game. But, you know, I if someone drops a combo piece like Goblin Bombardment down on the table, then I'm going to be more scared of that than I would be of a lot of other different cards. And, you know, Goblin Bombardment, case in point, isn't that like $6 or $7?
Probably a little more now.
A little more than that now. That's a good card. That's a very good card and a combo-tastic card. Money is not a thing that this is not a pay to win game per se, but oftentimes when you see certain cards, they are indicators, unless a person has told you otherwise at the beginning, you know, unless a person has said, hey, I'm running, okay, this is my, I'm digging deep into my collection of vintage rarities here and dumping them into a deck, in which case, you know, they're probably going to dirtle around a lot. Otherwise, it could be an indication that you're running into someone who's okay with dropping money on the most expensive cards, right? You know, again, there are multiple power levels. I don't think necessarily that buying the most expensive cards is necessarily is better than buying the second most expensive cards, which are oftentimes orders of magnitude cheaper. I think oftentimes the second or third tier cards are plenty fine.
But so kind of second tier win cons here, like the Toxic Deluge, the Slaughter of the Strong, things that are not quite the same, but are still fairly powerful.
I mean, why not play those? I mean, again, I'm not going to be as afraid of a person pulling out a third or fourth tier creature. But again, it also depends on what commander I'm seeing across the table.
Sure.
But, you know, Mana Crypt does, if you think about what Mana Crypt does, it gives you the possibility of getting two colorless for a zero drop. I mean, that is like, you know, we love Sol Ring in Commander, but even Sol Ring costs a mana, you know? I mean, it's kind of overkill almost if you're willing to spend that much on something, unless you're running in a format that specifically everything is going to be tuned to that marginal increase. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to get at here is, do you need that Mana Crypt in order to have a better deck than the deck with the Tormod's Crypt?
I mean, are you at a CEDH table and are you running a CEDH deck or a 100% power level deck? I mean, if you are, then all power to you. Then you're going to be trying to eke out every little nook and cranny of marginal power increase you can. If you're not, then you could probably drop down to tier two and you'd be just as fine.
Or just play Sol Ring.
Yeah, or just play Sol Ring. But, I mean, I would actually say I would play the other monolith. I can't remember. Not Grim
Basalt Monolith.
Basalt Monolith. I mean, that's a pretty reasonable alternative to both Grim Monolith and Mana Vault. Mana Crypt, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Basalt Monolith isn't like garbage bin in terms of price, but it's pretty good.
It's less than $10.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And it's no means like a cheap ass card, but what it is it's a good card and it's also not $100.
In your opinion, do you need to have an extremely expensive deck in order to be able to win a game of EDH?
Why would I? That's the big question. Would I? You can win with a game of EDH more often if you spend a lot of money on cards, but are you really going to feel better winning with that kind of deck versus spending less money on a deck?
And that's why I build the budget decks that I do, is that they are solid decks. They do the things that they're supposed to do. But again, they always try to find a way to have that interaction, to basically leave the door open for other people to be able to play Magic. Obviously, I'm trying to win every game I play. I'm never going to say I'm not trying to win. But the fact of the matter is, I'm trying to do something with a budget deck that you could technically do with an extremely expensive deck. I'm just making a conscious choice to try to use a whole bunch of cheap cards that maybe... the higher power levels considered to be trash, which may be quite good at the middle power levels. And I find a personal sense of satisfaction in doing that, just because you are trying an avenue less traveled. And it speaks to the whole point of what EDH is supposed to be, where it was the format for unplayable cards. It was the format for cards that weren't overly efficient. And I like being able to bring the spirit of that into a lot of my decks by making them budget, by making those conscious decisions to take out or not include expensive cards, to not include my Rhystic Study in every deck that runs blue, and just try to find some cheapo instance or something that allow me to draw cards. At some point, I feel like I'm doing something more because I'm not just grabbing through the staples that I have. I'm trying to put together this crazy puzzle using pieces that are not always the best, but which provide an interesting flavor and provide a challenge, honestly, in being able to not only build it, but also pilot the deck. And I get a lot of satisfaction out of trying to find those interactions that maybe people are sleeping on, or even things that I didn't even know really existed until I threw them in the deck. It's the journey of discovery is what brings me back to EDH. It's what pushes me into budget building. I'm not going to judge against people for spending a lot more on cards. Obviously, we all have our own financial circumstances. We all try to get the same thing out of EDH. We want to. It's just that in general, I just prefer to build budget decks just on principle, both on the fact that I don't really want to spend a whole ton on cards, and I just want to have those fun interactions where people are not going to see the same game from me twice. They're going to see my different decks. They do a whole lot of different things. I have a lot of fun. That's the whole point of the format. And if I want to play Tormoz Crypt over Mana Crypt, I'm going to do that. No questions asked.
I mean, in the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, if I was to go out and spend $500 on a deck, would that $500 deck bring me more joy in playing EDH than a $80 deck would, objectively? Given the average power level of a pod of people you're playing with, whether that includes people outside of your circle or whatnot, is that $500 deck going to give you more joy in playing than your $80 deck?
It's ultimately going to depend on what you're looking for, but again, where I was going with my earlier analogy is that the Mana Crypt, you're going to probably see a more powerful or at least a more expensive deck with the one running Mana Crypt than the one running Tormod's Crypt. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be stronger. I guess I just wanted to open up the discussion by saying that you don't have to have the most powerful cards to have a good synergistic deck, and that's where budget tries to fit in. You can run that Tormod script, and it can work absolutely bonkers good in the right deck. It's why we all run Bojuka Bog, or at least a lot of us run Bojuka Bog in our black decks.
I like Tormod script more than Bojuka Bog, but maybe I'm in the minority of people, because it seems like people strongly prefer Bojuka to the Tormod, but maybe I'm just old fogey here.
it does work in a different way, but the fact is that card can go in the perfect deck. If you can recur it, all of a sudden you can start hosing everyone else's graveyards. There might be some interesting synergies where you can just use that and it ends up being better than the Mana Crypt. Just because you throw a Mana Crypt in a deck doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be the most powerful deck. It probably will be, because again, I don't have a Mana Crypt. I'm not interested in going out and buying one anytime soon. And so I feel like And again, me putting a Mana Crypt in any of my decks is not going to make them functionally better than they already work at under $50 a piece. Just throwing in a random staple is not going to increase the power level of any of my decks just because it's in there. I'm not always going to draw the Mana Crypt. It's not going to make a huge bit of difference whether I throw it in there or not. If I draw it, great. If I don't, it's not doing me anything. Whereas that Tormod's Crypt, for the same mana cost, typically is going to, I guess what I'm trying to say here is that if it works with the synergy, I mean, if I throw Tormod's Crypt into any random deck, it's not going to make it any better either, in all cases. But if I work around it where that is a piece of the deck, it synergizes with everything else I'm doing, it can be extremely powerful, and in a lot of cases, more powerful than the Mana Crypt in the right deck, in which case I've just spent 15 cents, let's say, to pick up this cheapo common or uncommon that does a thing versus the Mana Crypt that I may not even draw half the time. So I guess what we are trying to say is that price is not always a guarantee of wins. Just because you drop $2,000 on a deck doesn't mean you're always going to win, and just because you're building a deck on a budget of less than $50 doesn't mean you're always going to lose every game of Magic. We're still looking at a law of averages. There's still other players at the table. And if you build your deck right, ultimately the synergy should be more important in the end than the dollar amount that you've put on the deck.
Yeah, plus your goal in building a deck is to have fun, and your goal in building your deck is just to not completely get curb stomped by your opponents, you know? And is including a Mana Crypt in your deck something that's necessary to prevent being curb stomped? I don't think it is. I think you'd do just fine with a Sol Ring personally, and those things are like only $2 each at this point because they've been reprinted all to death.
Yep.
And Sol Ring was before all the Commander shenanigans went on, back when it was like a $40 card or whatever. It was considered one of the most powerful artifacts ever printed in the game of Magic, and that's an uncommon. So I'm saying that, like, you don't have to spend a lot of money to get power. I mean, Arcane Signet is an example of power creep, and it's $3. So go out and buy Arcane Signets if you really want to be up on the curve. But I just don't think a Mana Crypt is what you're going to need to prevent yourself from dying all the time. I also don't think it will prevent you from dying. I mean, if you really don't want to die in a game, I mean, I think there are better ways to do that.
And whereas Tormod's Crypt could actually save you in the right situation, whereas Mana Crypt won't do anything for you if someone's trying to kill you or, you know, mass reanimation of their graveyard stuff, if Tormod's Crypt can do that.
If you're up against a Marin of Clan Nel'Toth deck and they're reanimating a gajillion creatures from the graveyard, your Tormod's Crypt is going to be worth a lot more money in that situation than you having a Mana Crypt on your side of the board, which is pretty useless in that situation.
Yeah, so it's all situational in the end. Mana Crypt may be better in some decks. Tormod's Crypt may be better in others. It also comes back down to finances. What can you afford? What do you want to spend on a card? And then also just synergy. So what I really want the listeners to get out of this episode is that we're not against people playing the game the way they want to. I just wanted to challenge the application of someone having a Mana Crypt in their deck means their deck is more powerful because they probably spent more on cards. And again, if you haven't tried budget building, I would definitely recommend you give it a try. It's something where you may not really know how to deal with it going in there. Maybe you're the kind of person who throws a lot of staples in your decks. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. There's a lot of these cards are staples for reasons. But building a budget deck, especially with a lot of extremely cheap cards, forces you to change your mindset in how you're building your decks, and you might actually learn something in the process. Or if you are building budget decks, just keep at it. I highly endorse building budget decks. They are some of the most fun things I've played. My quote-unquote best decks are more expensive. I have a deck or two that's probably $150 to $200 when you get all down to it. Obviously, I didn't spend all that money at the same time. I've been building over time. I don't play those decks in our pod very much because, again, in our meta, for instance, I don't need to do that, for instance. It's just not necessary because we have the right rough power level, everything. Everyone's kind of balanced in their own way. We're able to interact with each other. I don't need a Mana Crypt in order to be able to keep competitive at that level of play. But I can certainly use a Tormod's Crypt to do something, and it will always have a utility. So that's where I'm trying to go here, is that you do have to consider what other people are playing, but at the end of the day, you're building your deck for you, and whatever is in your budget, you go with that. Even if it seems extremely cheap, Tormod's Crypt can be extremely powerful. You just got to find the right applications for it. Mana Crypt, on the other hand, you know, it's great in some cases, not great in every case. Do you need it? No. Is it great? Sure. But again, just build the decks the way you want to be able to build them. Build them on your budget specifically. If you need to proxy, proxy. I have nothing against that. Just make sure, I guess, the ending point of this episode here, I guess, is to make sure and reevaluate the concept that you don't have to spend a lot of money to have a good deck. Budget decks can be good. Jank decks, again, in my episode, I mentioned jank decks. Those can be extremely powerful if you build them right. So don't fall into the trap where the guy at my local game store who had a $1,500 deck, don't fall into the trap of thinking that he's going to win every single game because he put the most money in on cards. He was beaten by pre-cons. Pre-cons can still be good if you put the time and the care into them. So if you want to build budget decks, go for it. Make them synergistic, and you can hang at a lot more tables than you think with a $50 deck. That's really where budget building goes from. I usually just throw cards from my long box together in a pile, and a lot of decks that I build don't even really make it past a couple of games. I end up tearing them apart. But every now and then there will be a deck there where it's just, you know, I've got something here. I'm going to add a few cards here and there, maybe drop another $10 on it. All of a sudden, that deck works really well. It works the way I want it to, or, you know, maybe opens up some new avenues. So definitely give budget building a try. There is nothing stopping a budget deck from hanging at the majority of tables. It is, if anyone tells you otherwise, they are lying. Budget decks can be powerful, and there definitely are a worthwhile way of playing this game.
That you can build a pretty dang good deck for like $70, you know, and you could probably match, especially if you play with a really good commander like Prosh, for instance. Probably match everything up to a power level of 8 on the even though I hate numerical scales in terms of power level rating, you know, you'll do just fine, and you won't need to not eat food for several months. You won't need to forego paying rent in order to afford your EDH deck, you know what I mean? And you'll be just fine, you know. You'll be able to match decks that are lower power and match decks that are higher power, and you'll have a lot of fun, and you'll probably get more enjoyment out of the game knowing that you didn't go without food for several months in order to do so, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that's gonna wrap things up here. Hopefully the listeners have gotten some interesting insights into why you don't have to spend an arm and a leg trying to be able to play Magic the Gathering playing EDH. The fact is, you put as much money into the game as you want to, and it shouldn't stop you from trying to be able to make a powerful deck. That's ultimately what we're trying to go for here. If you have a Mana Crypt, great. You should include it in your decks. But you don't have to feel like you absolutely need a Mana Crypt in order to be competitive, because ultimately, you don't.
Yep, anyway, exactly.
Anyway, so I'm going to close the show here, unless we have anything else going. I'm going to thank you, Ryan, for being on the show. It's been great, as always.
Whoop-de-doo. Yeah. That's another one down, and hopefully more to go.
All right, yeah, sounds good. All right, you can find me on Twitter at MTG in Quarantine. You can also find me, or you can also find the back catalog of this podcast on Spotify, Apple Casts, or Apple Podcasts, Google Casts, and wherever fine podcasts are found. So, again, for Ryan and for MJ, this is the MTG in Quarantine podcast. Have a great rest of your day.